Greetings, you happily miserable accursed. We've got Jordan Likeness here. Corey Tanike is here. Scott Reed is barely here, hanging on by the skin of his internet and technology. I'm David Hurley. No lollygagging today. We're tight for time. We got a big political week. It's budget day tomorrow. So let's get right to it. So much has been revealed about the budget already on a close to daily basis these past few weeks. We'll recap what we know and break down how we think it'll play. Our cursed clipping is Shannon Proudfoot's opinion piece in the Globe and Mail on Trudeau's performance as that guy at the Foreign Interference Inquiry. Then we'll dissect the carbon tax fight between the Prime Minister and the Premiers. Who's winning this thing? And finally, Gordon Pinsett will bring curse to a close with our Hey Yous. Scott, Corey, Jordan, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. Scott and Corey, you were at the press gallery dinner on Saturday night. I wasn't there. I was out celebrating my goddaughter Ava Bird's 16th birthday, so I feel very virtuous about that. But you guys were at the press gallery dinner, and you know, if you're not at that event, it's probably the kind of thing that people hate most about politics. All the journalists and all the politicians get together and laugh about the issues of the day and make fun of it. It's the ultimate insidery event. So, Corey, did you have fun?
It was, you know, you get to connect with a bunch of people, but it was sort of one of many. It was at the Manning Center Conference, although it's not called that anymore, but I'll still call it that, in reverence to the great Preston Manning. And we were at the Civics Conference for what used to be called Student Vote. So Scott and I spent a lot of time together this weekend. It was quite nice.
Lovers in a dangerous time.
That's right.
For the sake of clarity, I was not at the Manning Center conference.
We're going to need your alibi, Scott.
Yeah. No invitations have ever been forthcoming to that event for me. I don't understand why. Yeah, you mentioned how, like, you know, it could be a bad look for all the politicians and media to get together and be laughing in an insidery way, David. The only caution I would place on that analysis is that there was so little laughter. It was nice. It was sincerely nice to see so many familiar faces and some unfamiliar faces, and lots of people had plenty of fun things to say. But from the stage, humor was in grossly low supply. So it is an event that is in need of a comedian scalpel. It needs to be recrafted, and it's so desperately unfunny. The bombing of Israel by Iranian drones also dampens the mood somewhat, anyway, it was good to be there nevertheless. But if you went looking for a Ricky Gervais style cut up of the crowd, you did not find it.
Well, there you go, folks. You missed out on nothing. Okay. Well, here we go.
At the very end of the speeches, Liz May stood up and we thought, oh my God, what's going to happen here? Because last time she went kind of dizzy and crazy. But she stood up and she told an actual joke. It had a beginning, a setup, it had a little middle, and then it had a punchline. It wasn't a brilliant joke, but it was a joke. I stood up at the table and screamed, a joke, a fucking joke. Like a man lost in the desert searching for fluids. I found a joke. A whole mother of a night.
All right. Let's fire up the curse machine. It's more entertaining than press gallery dinner. We've reached the end of our pre-budget roadshow. Budget's tomorrow. I think they've really done it well in many respects. They showed a real emphasis on housing, and they've got a plan that seems to be pretty well received. Most people are saying there's lots of things there that are good ideas and going to make a difference. Alongside that, they had initiatives like school food that few people are going to be against, hard to be against, and they had support for artificial intelligence for those people who say they don't care about economic growth. There's one more piece to go in the budget itself, and that's the revenue measures that they intend to bring in to offset this spending. I think they see that as offense rather than defense also. So they've been trying to find policy cleavages and fights wherever they can find them, and I was encouraging them to do that. So I find this encouraging. Most of the fights they've found have been in provincial capitals. The questions I'm left with are, it's a lot of spending, But there's no single initiative that is narrative changing in and of itself. Point number one. Point number two is, do enough people hear it the way that they've been distributing it without advertising or promotion and just through traditional media sources and unpromoted social? Do enough people hear it? And the last thing is, obviously, will people still respond positively to Trudeau? So, Corey, what's your take on what they've been doing for the last couple of weeks?
Well, they've actually been communicating proactively, I think, for the first time in a couple of years. And what a difference it makes in terms of the outcomes. You have people reacting to the things you're saying as opposed to just reacting to things that are either happening in the general events-based world of politics or responding to attacks from premiers or the opposition. So I think it's certainly a step in the right direction in terms of comms rollout. I think the answer to your question on do enough people see it, I think the answer is no. And that's not a failing in the comms plan. It's a failing in the lack of an advertising budget and just the nature of how media is consumed these days. So until they get over themselves, and I would have included in that budget a change to advertising rules if I were them, and acting in the interests of the government to something that's more akin to what you see in every other provincial capital and what you've seen in previous federal governments, frankly. So I think that would be doing themselves a big favor if they wanted to say what's the next step level of improvement that you could bring to the operation. I think it would be that. But insofar there's a plan and they've been sticking to it, I think it's been going well. It's not, the budget's not for everyone. Like I fear we're going to see some tax increases and things that I don't like very much. But we'll see what happens tomorrow.
You're going to see some tax increases, that's for sure.
Yeah, probably. As I say, I'm self-interested.
If they don't hit you, then that is the least fucking design. That is the jankiest wealth tax.
You should see the price of those new Ferraris. They're off the charts. I need every penny I can scrounge together.
You hear the sound of struggle here, friends.
Yeah.
There you go.
Who are the innovators, Hurlyburlyites? The ones who see beyond status quos, the ones who make new and better. I treaded lightly onto this topic last week. In the world of telecom, I have to think our presenting sponsor, TELUS, operates with a more open, more willing, more inventive mindset than most of their competition. Their list of firsts to better connect us is long. I mean, this is the 232nd ad in this series, 232. I've told a lot of those innovation stories. TELUS would like to bring that mindset eastward into Ontario and Quebec as a skin-in-the-game provider of fiber internet. I'll spare you any long-winded explanation of market forces and just say this. Innovation generally means better outcomes for customers because the competition gets pushed to improve their own products and services in order to keep up. So here's an example of innovative thinking TELUS can bring to more customers east. It's from their subsidiary, Koodo Mobile, and it's called the Happy Stack. Short story, Koodo Internet was deployed in Manitoba, Ontario, and Quebec just last October. The Happy Stack followed quickly. Basically, it's a first-of-its-kind bundle, letting customers stack up their cell phone plan, home internet, and entertainment streaming, Netflix, Disney+, Amazon Prime, at unbeatable value, savings of up to 23%. The Happy Stack is just one example, but it's predictive of the good that can come when TELUS is allowed to bring new thinking into new territories. Customers want new, better, and more affordable ways to get the stuff that matters to them. What TELUS wants is to bring sustainable wholesale wireline to the east, where the CRTC has deemed the need for competition most urgent, and bring them more of that stuff. Scott, I'm going to put you up against the wall.
Yeah.
2 or 3 weeks from now, will we see any reflection of this effort in polling data? Even whether it's not vote intent, are we going to see any change in approval of the government, any change in their strength in any policy areas, anything, any underlying movement?
Since I don't know, I'll say yes. What the fuck? I'll take a leap on yes. I agree with what everybody has had to say. I think the persistence of the effort, I think the deliberateness of it makes a lot of sense. it started to chip away at my cynicism. So I think that's one tiny measure of it. My reason that I would bet that it's going to make some change is that the government has robbed itself of tools, as we've talked about, you know, inexhaustibly. It's robbed itself of government advertising, and it's robbed itself of partisan advertising. And in the current media environment, as we've said over and over, that makes it really hard to break through. I think they've done what they can in order to you know, in order to accumulate issues and earn media and try to break through. And I think that even overall, you know, allowing that no single narrative punches through, David, I think they've associated themselves with a couple of priorities. And I think that's been the first part of it. And that's been the roll up to the budget. I think the budget itself, joking aside, I think there is going to be news in the budget itself. And I think it's going to be hang the rich. And I think that's going to create a sharp debate. And, you know, part of it will be about, you know, spending and taxing and that sort of stuff. But I think that that's a trap. I think they're trying to set a trap. That's my guess. That's what they're going to do on budget day. And I think that will have some narrative. It will force a debate and discussion. And I think that that will punch through a bit. So I think the roll up is going to have a benign positive impact because they associate themselves with the priority of housing, which people say, well, at least they seem to be alert to it now. And I think that budget day is actually going to give us a narrative around taxation, and it's going to be a little class oriented, and I think it's going to create a very difficult pitch for the Conservatives to lay off of. And I think, you know, that is a chance to punch through and maybe gradually, you know, marginally help the Liberals in terms of right direction, wrong direction, and, you know, where they're at. The one thing I would say is I'm astonished at the number of people that have said this to me, and I read it even again this morning somewhere. Gosh, they've left themselves nothing to say in the budget itself. I mean, how fucking dumb do people have to be to think that folks would deliberately design this, then execute against it for 2 weeks, and like, oh gosh, oink, I forgot to leave myself something to say on budget day.
Well, that's why... That's why I believe that they see the tax measures as offense rather than defense. There is nothing that they've announced so far that they would have expected the Conservatives to fight them on. Right?
That's right.
But that's what they, expecting. I think, and are expecting the Conservatives to fight them on whatever they do on taxes. And they want that fight. Jordan, what's your thinking about that? And is the tax fight a good one for them to have?
So good. It's so good for them to have it. Like, this is really the first attempt that we've seen on their part, if they do as we expect them to do, which is to come forward on the revenue side, either with some sort of corporate excess profit tax, something on the high income individuals, maybe both. That would be great. Like, they are now fishing in a populist pond. And that is the first time that they are really trying to aggressively get onto that territory where they can have a toe-to-toe fight with Polyev about that. I think it's smart. I think it's great politics for them to have that be the fight that they're picking on budget day. We know from public opinion polling that a lot of Canadians do lay the blame at the feet of corporate Canada for various affordability ills, from housing to grocery prices. People are in a mood on this stuff, and I think it's really smart to take advantage of that. My questions about the overall success of the strategy, I think, go more towards what you were saying earlier, David. I think my question is, first and foremost, with the messenger, with Trudeau still as the key person delivering this, are people listening? Are people open to that? Are they able to hear that also without any paid behind it? I'm not so persuaded about that. But on the other hand, if, as this government has done, if paid is off the menu for you for you know, many reasons, which we can certainly quibble about, I think that they've done the best that they could conceivably do in order to set the table for this. And the rhythm of announcements over the last couple of weeks has been really good, really strong. And I think, like, it's interesting, they're doing something that I think we're seeing more and more in successful campaigns, which is, rather than doing, you know, like, we all remember the days where it was like one campaign announcement, one topic per day, and you change topics like every day. It was like a new thing. But they have picked a topic, and in this case, it's housing, and they've largely hammered in different ways on it over the course of a longer period. And I think that that will yield them much better success than peppering around a lot of different small things on various topics. And actually, the housing announcement that we saw on Friday started to finally really match the scope and the tenor of what Minister Fraser has been out talking about in terms of the generational challenge. And so I thought that was very well done leading into the weekend of the budget coverage. The other question, though, that I have is that can they keep this up? Can they keep this up after the budget? How long is this going to last? This is what they're doing is very resource intensive, and it's something that is unfamiliar to the current team, the current communications team around the PMO. I think we can safely say that, because if it wasn't, they'd have been fucking doing this a year ago, right? So I think that there's questions about how long this can endure after the rollout of this. For their sake, hopefully this is a more permanent change in their communications ability. But whether this is actually going to connect with the millennial voters that all the stuff is aimed at, that I'm not so sure about. I'm not so sure that it gets out of some of the mainstream coverage that they've had and into voters' minds. And in part, that's because of the messenger.
They're not going to get those millennials. They're not. Mm-hmm. And I don't care. They're trying
to talk to them. Like if you look at these announcements, that is squarely who this is about. You don't talk childcare. You don't talk, school nutrition. You don't talk, that is really who this is for. So
they say that by targeting those groups, by trying to address them through the camera lens, they are speaking as much to their moms and grandmoms. Of course, the shithead men are gone, but that's what they will tell you, and that's what they're briefing.
Well, why wouldn't they speak directly to those people?
I know. I follow you, and they think that this gives them a wider berth, that they get the millennials, and the moms and grandmoms who are worried about the fortunes of the millennials. I personally think it's skeptical.
An unproven theory at this point, whether that's successful.
I think if you're driving to Japan, you take the bridge, okay? I don't think, you get there by, some other means.
I would recommend a plane myself.
A metaphor that fell like the fucking bridge in Baltimore there.
Okay, we're going to send Scott a map for Christmas.
There's no doubt, Corey, that the overall emphasis was on housing. But there was also, especially if you include the PharmaCare announcement, there's been a lot of money dribbled here and dribbled there. Some more money for childcare, some money for school food, some money for this. Do you think they'd have been better off with one big thing than with putting a little bit of money into a number of things?
Well, perhaps, but I don't think that's where these announcements fall apart thematically. I think they're too focused on the NDP's agenda, which is for renters, not homeowners, or those aspiring to be homeowners. I think it skews too low income. And it's not to say that those policies are necessarily bad from a policy perspective. I'll leave that to smarter people than me.
Low income and marginalized people vote at much lower rates, no matter what policies you put in the window, than wealthier people.
That's what I'm saying. And in terms of the housing, I've said it many times before, I'll say it again for good measure. Millennials are renting. They want to own. They want a mortgage. And doing purpose-built rental housing is the answer to the wrong question. And for a lot of those voters. And I think that Polyev gets that. And I think that's why he's talking about home ownership. And I think they are trying to keep their coalition agreement together as opposed to targeting the voters that they're losing to the conservatives. So
I don't know, Corey. I agree with you, aspiration. Go ahead.
I agree that, there's no question that there's a strong aspiration for home ownership on the part of millennials. We just did some research with the Broadbent Institute on this. And absolutely. But 80% of millennials in, we're talking about markets like Vancouver and Toronto, they want to own a home. But also the vast majority of them understand that that's not happening anytime in the near future. And they hold the federal government as being one of the main actors responsible for the current housing crisis. They very much want to see the federal government getting back into the business of building and supporting housing. They view that as part of what's the action that they want to see from government. So I don't think you can read directly that the aspiration for owning a home means that any of these other potential policy solutions aren't appealing to that crowd. I think that's a simplistic argument that doesn't actually capture
how people care about. I don't think people care about policies, period. I think they care about outcomes. Right?
They care about outcomes.
They care about outcomes. So I agree with you, Corey, that owning a home is...
Who is carrying the banner on that issue? Who looks like they understand the problem?
Yep, it's saying you're...
But at the end of the day, wait, let me just put this to you, because this is the way I see it. It's the way I see it. So if a person is currently renting, they want a home. I agree with you, Corey. That's their aspiration. The question is... Does that mean they're going to turn down rent control, for example? If somebody was putting rent control on the table, right? Are they going to be more attracted to somebody that says, I'm going to freeze your rent today? Or somebody that, like Polyev, that says, well, I will get houses built and someday you'll be able to buy a house. Like, so I do think that there's stages and phases to this, right? A rational person says, I am renting. It will be a number of years until I can buy a house, but my rent's becoming fucking unaffordable.
Sure, but they're 90% focused on the wrong part of the problem in terms of what the actual announcements are. Like, you know, the announcements and the money and all of this is way, way more focused on the rental market than it is on the home ownership market. And, you know, I think the politics of that is just wrong for them. I think it's right for the NDP. The NDP does well with the rental market. And, you know, if you're asking who's driving the car right now, it seems a lot more that it's Jagmeet Singh than Justin Trudeau on these issues.
Yeah,
and that is not in the political interest of Justin Trudeau, if you ask me.
Yeah, these are absolutely policies that are super appealing to NDP voters. So
yeah, but why are they fishing? Why are they fishing in the NDP pool? Like, there's almost nobody left there. Like, right. They obviously need to be getting at the other people's vote pool. Scott, do you got anything to close on this?
Well, I've thought a lot about that last issue, and I think I've always had a sneaking suspicion there is a defensive element to this strategy and the messaging and the policy priority, which is that they want to stem any potential flow of voters to the NDP and possibly collapse some of it. But, you know, that's not what they say. When you ask them that, they deny that. They say, no, this is an offensive play, and that actually by going after those younger voters, we have a shot at some of them that have gone to the conservatives, and we got a shot at their moms and grandmoms. I'm not convinced that works. I'm not as doctrinaire about it as Corey. I don't think you can only think in terms of voters as those who have a 1.25 acre lot. I think there's more voters than that out there. But you know, they've got work. I also, here's the last thought. You detect from them an attitude that they're going to chip away, that they're going to take 4 to 5%, through the budget process, and then they're going to turn their guns and try to take another 4 to 5%. And, you know, that makes some sense. I'm just not as convinced about their demographic targeting as they are.
Yeah, you know, Chris Arnotti, who I have had on the Hurly Burly a couple of times and whom I'm a big fan of, had a social media post today where he said, and Corey, I'm just going to be reinforcing your point. He said that he thought most of the Europeans he's met in his walks would happily trade their tiny apartment 3 miles from downtown and their shitty little car that they have for the American lifestyle. And he doesn't think many Americans would trade the other direction.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So I want to talk about data again. And I don't mean the friendly android on Star Trek. I'm a pollster. I know the importance of data. Fact is, absent data, you can't make a meaningful plan or strategy or business model or even a sensible decision. As the legendary American economist and thinker W. Edwards Deming famously put it, without data, you're just another person with an opinion. So where am I going with this? I'll tell you. We're emerging from an extraordinarily chaotic period. The COVID pandemic and foreign wars, among other things, showed us the fragility of the supply chains we all took for granted pre-2020. Who'd have ever thought new car showrooms would be empty? Anyway, the federal government is carrying out a serious reevaluation of our supply chains. It has opened a new office responsible for overseeing them. Our sponsor, CN, applauds that. The railway is without question the iron spine of Canada's supply chains. And CN believes any supply chain solutions begin with data transparency. Every week, CN posts data on its operations, right down, for example, to every carload of grain moved. It reveals how much of the railway's capacity was used by shippers, what kind of cargo its trains carried, and how many cars went empty. That's in addition to reams of data the railway provides to federal regulators. Other businesses, though, are less enthusiastic about transparency. They consider data to be trade secrets. That has to change. Any serious effort to repair or protect our supply chains will require widespread data transparency. It's quite literally a matter of national security. All right. Let's have some fun. Shannon Proudfoot wrote a piece in the Globe and Mail, and boy, I got to tell you folks, I fucking love this woman's writing. Like, I just get a kick out of everything she writes. And this piece is sublime. I can only read a segment of it, but by God, people, go read this. It's funny as fuck. All right. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was on the first sentence of his first answer at the public inquiry into foreign interference when it became clear that, he'd summoned that guy. You know the guy. Ask him a factual question, and the response is a purring, generic value statement so distantly related to the original question they could legally be married. It's not always that guy who shows up. Usually, but not always. And what makes that guy so vexing is that he doesn't have to exist, or at least he doesn't have to visit so often. The last time Mr. Trudeau took the witness chair at a public inquiry during the Public Order Emergency Commission in 2022, everybody got a load of the other guy. He walked through his thinking in detail. He acknowledged doubt and trade-offs. He explained complicated situations in a way that made it clear why the Prime Minister has a reputation as a keen study. The other guy is both more impressive, that is, more politically useful, and more straightforward. It's a shame he doesn't get out much. Scott, what's your assessment of the Prime Minister at the Foreign Interference Committee?
More importantly, let's start with my assessment of Shannon Proudfoot. I share your enthusiasm for her. I think she is a goddamn gem in the crown of national media, and I just love everything that she writes. I couldn't agree with her more. I just want to seize on the point that she made, the very specific point she made, because I was on television prior to the Prime Minister's testimony being asked questions like, what will we see and what will he be saying? And I foolishly made the exact prediction she hints at in this column, which is we'd see the guy that came before the Road Commission, that we would see him in a setting where there's, you know, rules and structure and the ability to skate around the ice and show people what kind of athlete you are. We would see that guy. We would see him walking us through the thinking and the alternatives and some of the nuance and considerations. And she's so right. Like, we did not get that. I was made a fool of. Like, that's not what we got. We got that kind of that curtain that falls where it's just like, well, as a liberal, I begin by thinking correctly, and then I do some more thinking, which is also correct. And if you thought like me, then you would be correct too. So that's how the world works. Like, it's just, it's galling. I agree with the Prime Minister's assertion, which enraged some people, that you got to be very careful about the briefings you get and the information you receive. And I do think that from the intelligence sources, from the intelligence agencies, and I do think that I encountered it particularly in my time in politics around, you know, Sikh issues. There would be, you know, this dynamic of a lot of the work is compiled at you know, with mid-level agents. They report up to their bosses. They view political activity, particularly diaspora-related political activity, with a very suspicious eye. So whether it's Tamil Tigers or World Sikh, or whether it's, you know, obviously in this case, you know, Chinese, and there's this working assumption that there's something afoot. Their understanding and appreciation of political processes around nominations and that sort of stuff is extremely lacking, and therefore they misidentify and misinterpret things. Not to say, obviously, there isn't efforts to tamper, but the conclusion that those efforts have been successful are often overheated and overwrought. And when those mid-level agents that are drafting that material don't get from their bosses at the senior levels the kind of excited response they wish, Well, then they go to media and leak that content, which is inappropriate. And then this whole thing comes at a hyperventilated topspin way through the media, and then political actors retrench and they turn into that guy. And, you know, and, or, you know, as Shannon puts it, because they go somewhat mute. So I think the Prime Minister made some valid points, but I didn't get the performance I expected from him. And I was disappointed in that, because I thought if he was going to make a point that's so sharp, which it is, to say, you have to understand the filter that we must put through these kinds of briefings, then you've got to be candid and direct, and you got to explain your thinking. And it was unaccompanied by that. So all you got was headlines saying the Prime Minister doesn't always trust his agencies, which is not...
Or doesn't always read his reports, which wasn't a great admission.
No, that was, that is puzzling. Right. We learned that he basically works not through briefing note, but by verbal briefing, which, you know,
anyway. He says if it's important, you have to say it to him directly. So, Prime Minister, you're losing. I'm going to say it to you directly. Do something different. You know, just to go back to Shannon Proudfoot's point, Jordan, this is his default. Like, it is the emergencies inquiry that was unique, because this is his default. I'm talking seriously about serious issues to you.
Tone of voice fucking sucks. It fucking sucks. It's absolutely. I think it's his worst mode, and I agree. Like, I actually with Scott, I expected to see much more of a Rulo Commission performance on this. I would say that there is more risk to the Prime Minister in these hearings than there was in the Rouleau Commission. And the Rouleau Commission, politically, by the time the commission rolled around, I think things are pretty baked in. Either, you know, and it was a bit a 90-10 issue, right? You agreed with the Prime Minister and what they did to quash the convoy occupation, or you didn't, right? This issue, I think there's actually quite a bit more vulnerability, because it hinges on what he did or did not know about what was going on with foreign interference, with his own MPs being involved, with Liberal Party nominations being heavily implicated. So this, to me, actually is a much more dangerous zone for him to be in. And I would expect that the preparation would be all the tighter in respect of that. But instead, what we got, we got the condescending philosopher, right? Which is, I think, just the wrong tone, for one thing. And it was also the wrong content. So, and Susan Delacour wrote a little bit about this, I think maybe more flatteringly than the Prime Minister deserved, but he was also very partisan. So he went out and he was taking swipes at Polyev, taking swipes at Harper. And it's not to say that there's no place for that. You know, I think that the way the Conservatives are flirting with pro-Russian disinformation is absolutely a vulnerability that the Liberals should be talking about, but not in that fucking room. Like, it does a disservice to him, and it also does a disservice to the issue, because the absolute last thing that anybody who's the Prime Minister of this country should want to have happen to this inquiry is for it to become more polarized around partisan divide. I think that, frankly, and this is, I'm going to be real earnest here, I think that's very bad for the country. I think it's absolutely irresponsible. And so I did not like seeing that at all. And then I think on a practical level, he did himself no favors when it appeared, you know, to be blaming his security advisors. And like, that little back and forth is not cute. I think there's certain, like, you have to be very careful when you're picking a fight with a security apparatus. These people will protect themselves.
This government throws bureaucrats under the bus more frequently than other governments I remember.
Totally, but they also do it badly. And so I do not expect the Prime Minister and the PMO to come out on top of that fight. Our intelligence agencies are sitting on a lot of information that can find its way places that are not favorable to the government. So I would be real cautious about that approach. And then the other thing, I think that, and you hit on this a little bit, David, is the daylight between what he said and what Katie Telford said in their testimony about whether or not he reads every piece of intelligence briefing that comes before him. Now, we can quibble. I don't think it's realistic to assume that the Prime Minister would read every single piece. But if that's not the case, then don't fucking say it in sworn testimony. Because now there's a front that has been opened up there between them that I think is going to come back to haunt him in a big way. I think it's reasonable that the Prime Minister would receive oral briefings. I mean, we have all briefed principals. We've all briefed, you know, people who are in high office, everybody has a different style for what sticks with them. And if his is oral, fine, that's okay. But don't allow there to be testimony to the contrary that makes it seem like somebody's not telling the truth. So overall, I think the performance was very poor. And I think that worse than that, it's really going to come back to haunt this government and to haunt Trudeau personally as this issue continues to unfold.
Well, let's pick up on that, Corey, because I'll be honest, my assessment would be that the appearance was terrible and that his staff didn't do all that well either. That it was the complete opposite of the Rollo Commission in terms of the government's performance. But I still don't think it matters a fuck. I don't think there's any votes in this. I don't think anybody's paying attention. I don't think anybody cares. And I think this is really an Ottawa issue.
I agree with all that. And I think you've seen the Conservatives course correct from what they did back when this issue first emerged, where it became basically all they were focusing on in question period, etc. And their fortune suffered as a result. And I don't think it's because the government looks great. I just think, you know, at the end of, you know, spending 4 months talking about this, it didn't really rise in the issue matrix for anybody. And very few people were following the story on an ongoing basis. So, I think it's a distraction, but I think Proudfoot's point in the piece is really the salient point from this episode. And we saw it in another interview that I'll throw a shout out on as well. Justin Ling's interview with the Prime Minister for The Walrus. I listened to it, and there was a lot of similar themes. And it's become a trap for him. And I think it's one of the reasons why he's having difficulty connecting with people. It's the tone.
He's edgy, eh? Like Delacorte wrote about this too. He's pissed off.
Well, I would say
he's not getting enough love for how good a job he's doing. He's doing a very good job. He's working very hard.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, it's chippy, but it's indignant is the word that I was coming back to in terms of what his tone is. And it's gaslighting, you know, voters that, you know, the problems that are real and obvious to everyone in the country are actually just a problem with your perspective. And if only you fixed your perspective, then you would be happy and these problems wouldn't seem so problematic anymore. But that condescending, indignant, shitty tone just creates space between you and voters that you're trying to actually drive a message to. Like they have to believe first and foremost that you see the problems that they see. And that you have some idea as to what you're going to do to change them. Like the very definition of a government that's out of gas, that's long in the tooth, is one that becomes so, you know, self-insulated that they are no longer capable of seeing the obvious, and they have no thoughts or ideas on how to make those things better. So, you know, when you've got 80% of the country that agrees with Polio that everything's broken, I wouldn't recommend that you go out and say, the problem is your perspective. Everything's just fine. Thank you very much. It really makes people think that there's no path for you going forward. I know we want to move on to other things, but I also want to say one other thing, because, you know, Scott's assessment of, you know, the reality around the intelligence relationship with the Prime Minister's office, I agree you should question intelligence. I agree with all of that part of it. Okay, but what was absolutely lacking and absolutely obvious in these hearings is if they'd gone and sat down for 5 minutes with Han Dong, he would have been thrown out of caucus right away. Because if you want to talk about bad performances, the worst performance of all the bad performances was Han Dong. And if you listened to that conversation with him and didn't come away saying...
Do you mean you
saying,
would remember if busloads of international students
were... Oh, well, you remember them later. And you know, well, okay, I didn't say leave the two Michaels rotting in jail. I can't remember whether I had that conversation. I might have, but I can't really remember what I said. You know, it all just
I would remember
as,
what I said.
You are a fucking liar. You're a fucking liar. And you have no place in the caucus. And so, you know, trying to say that intelligence information is like court testimony. It isn't. It's intelligence information. It's not evidence. All right. It is indications with a probability of risk associated with them. But you take that information, you go and do something with it. And the obvious thing that you or I, or I think any reasonable political staffer would do is go and sit down with the person who these accusations are about and have your own one-on-one assessment as to whether or not they're fucking full of shit. And in the case of Han Dong, fucking full of shit.
I thought Dom obviously. Had been meeting with them a number of times or something. I thought there'd been meetings. In any event,
obviously not very pressing.
Can I just make one quick last note? And I know I'm the one that's itching for time, but this whole point about tone, voice, the guy, the other guy, all that showing up, I think it's so important. But it's also a profoundly common symptom of incumbency, right? Like, I've got the chance to work with and watch two prime ministers up close and observe many others. And this is not, and premiers and so forth. And this is not the first time you've seen this phenomenon. It is when you are in the office, the pressures you manage, the burdens you bear, the constraints you operate under, all of it accumulates over time to a creeping resentment that people don't recognize what you're up to and you don't get credit for that. And you have to meet people where they are. You got to connect people with where they are. And, you know, I know it's impossible advice to sometimes take, but it's a, like, at some point when you're a prime minister in your seventh, eighth, ninth year, it's a really good idea to slam back a glass of whiskey, look in the mirror and ask yourself, if I was running as the leader of the opposition, what would I do? What choices would I make if I was trying to take government rather than occupy and defend government? And, you know, that insurgency mindset in the place of incumbency, it's hard to conjure, but boy, oh boy, oh boy, it's so important. And if there's anything that can be done, and there may not be anything, but if there's anything that can be done to revive Trudeau's fortunes, he's got to dump what Shannon calls that guy, and he's got to look in the mirror and ask himself, what would I be doing if I was running as the opposition leader, if I was an insurgent rather than incumbent? You got to try to conjure that mentality and that feral, striking desire. It seeps away from you when you're in office.
Ontario is now celebrating 10 years of being coal-free, having burned its last piece of coal in 2014 and becoming the first jurisdiction in North America to fully eliminate coal-fired electricity. This was touted as the single largest GHG reduction initiative in North America, eliminating more than 30 megatons of annual GHG emissions, equivalent to taking 7 million vehicles off the road. Also, 2014 was the first time since Ontario's air quality monitoring program began in 1993 that no smog advisories were issued in the province, a feat accomplished many times over in the 10 years since. What people may not be aware of is how Ontario phased out coal while still maintaining a reliable and affordable electricity grid for homes, businesses, and hospitals in Ontario. So let me shed a little smog-free light on that. Today's podcast sponsor, Bruce Power, is a nuclear generating facility in Tiverton, Ontario, that currently supplies about 30% of Ontario's electricity. When Bruce Power restarted four of its eight nuclear units between 2003 and 2012, after being shut down in the 1990s, it provided 70% of the generation required to phase out coal. As nuclear power increased and displaced coal-fired electricity, Ontario's carbon emissions decreased. In short, nuclear up, smog down. Fast forward 10 years later, Bruce Power is continuing to invest in its nuclear generating units to ensure a clean, reliable supply of electricity for decades to come, which will be vital in supporting Canada's climate goals. One quick comms point. Anybody jump in on this? Do you think that the housing initiatives would be going over better if the government had preceded it with an ounce of humility about their record to date? How do you feel about that? Like, I'm a big believer in that. Like, say the truth to people, right? And then you can execute a pivot. But as long as they keep saying, we've been working at this since 2015, we had a big housing strategy in 2017, this is just a continuation of our fine work for the last 8 years, it makes it difficult for people to see it as something different and a change.
I think it would be really wise for Trudeau to consider running against Trudeau. This is something that at this point he really ought to consider, because his personal negatives and the view that people have of him as being responsible for the crisis that we're in, like, it's okay to say that you're changing course. I mean, like, Lord love a duck, Doug
Ford. We had COVID. There's a million excuses for what, you know.
There's a lot of excuses. There's a lot of excuses. And I think you just, you have to lean into authenticity when you do that, which is at times a struggle for this PMO. But I don't think it's beyond their reach. The Prime Minister is a formidable campaigner. And I think that if he were to, you need to create a break with your past self, right? But it takes a lot for a government or for any party, frankly, and for any leader to want to create that break with their past record. And I think that one of the challenges that the Liberals currently face is that they're out there looking for cookies for their previous work when people don't feel like it even deserves a passing grade.
No. Mm-hmm. But as Scott said, you got to approach it from, if other people came in here, what would they do? If unencumbered by all of our baggage, unencumbered by the need to be defensive about the decisions we've made, what would they do?
Well, right? And I have a hard time imagining that pre-2015 Liberals would look at this and think that it's a winning strategy.
And look, you know, you're making in precise terms the point I was trying to make in abstract terms, you know, about, you know, meet people with where they're at, so on and so forth. I'll just add this specific tactical suggestion as well. Too often, communications from government, and particularly incumbent governments, and particularly now this government, right, begin with throat clearing. Like, your communications literally begin with throat clearing. Since 2015, we've been working hard to help those in the middle class and those seeking to join it. Our plan, blah, blah, blah. As you say, David, right? But the most important thing that people hear is the first fucking thing they hear from you. And so when you begin with this boilerplate throat clearing that appears to be disconnected from the experience of people and suggests an assertion that people don't agree with, they don't hang out.
No, the first thing you say is bullshit. They're not going to listen to the second thing.
So I tune out. That's right. Right? throat clearing communication should be banned.
Yeah. All right. Quickly. We can't have an episode without talking about the carbon tax. Can we, for God's sake? And
for the love of God, can we?
God love the NDP for putting this back on our agenda this week. So the PM and the carbon tax, he's now alone. Maybe one or two premiers on his side, depending how EB feels on any given day, right? The federal NDP abruptly bail at the Broadbent Institute. Trudeau seems to relish all this. He's the only one standing up to political pressure to do the right thing for the planet. And he's going to stand and fight. Jordan, for the 100th time on this program, how's this going to turn out for him?
Like, not well, guys. It's not going to turn out well. There is no turning the carbon tax ship around at this point. And I think that the Liberals would be wise to, the NDP is making a pivot on this for a reason, right? There are a lot of ways to get to the place of reducing emissions to meet the federal targets. There are many, many paths to that. It doesn't make any political sense to go to bat for the one mechanism that seems to have coast-to-coast hatred on the part of the voters that you need to appeal to. It just doesn't make any sense for anybody to carry water on that. And in fact, if you look even to the Liberals' own talking points on the federal backstop, it's that it's just that. It is a backstop. It's actually not really supposed to be the main climate plan in Canada. It's supposed to encourage provinces to adopt their own plans. And so you see Manitoba going down that path. I reiterate my thought that the federal Liberals should be hugging Premier Canoe for all he's worth, for his desire to take them up on that offer in the Prairies. This is not, like, they are not going to turn this around by talking about the rebate, because the rebate is also reiterating that you are taking money away from people. So it's a bit of a circular logic. If you go talking about the rebate, you're also talking about the tax, and that is a losing frame for you. So I think that for the many bright policy people who are still kicking around the PMO and looking at this issue, now is the time to chart a path for what it looks like to get to those emissions targets by another route. And I mean, I'm old enough to remember that, like, way back in 2008 and in 2011, we prosecuted, in the NDP at that time, there were two federal campaigns where we were fighting about how we were going to price carbon. The carbon tax is not the only way to do this. And in fact, it hasn't been NDP policy right from the beginning. They were always in favor of cap and trade. So I don't think that it's surprising to see that there would be flexibility on the part of other progressive parties in how you would get to that end goal. They see the writing on the wall. And by the way, when and if Pierre Poilievre is prime minister, this policy is also dead as a doornail. So why don't you find something that has even if it's not as beautiful economically, it's not as clean, that's okay. Let's find something that can withstand political rigor.
Has anybody ever seen an opposition leader do what Poilievre's done on this issue, which is take something that was relatively innocuous and beat on it so hard that the government has to withdraw? It's pretty impressive. He's changed the whole nature of the discussion on this.
Yesterday, and I really think that like the pain point that made it possible is the fact that it increases over time. Because if it weren't for that April 1st increase that's tangible, like you got really something good to hang your hat on there.
Look, where this thing fell apart is when they did the exemption for home heating fuel in Atlantic Canada. Yeah, that's when it fell apart.
Yeah,
that's when it fell apart, because then there was nobody, including the prime minister, actually arguing for the policy, right. and he had conceded all the main arguments on it. So, that's where it went from bad to cataclysmically bad for them. So they lament the loss of this policy. They should look in the mirror. It's they themselves who I think are the architects of its demise ultimately.
Agreed.
I'll say this last thing on this, because we talked about it exhaustively and we all know where we are. It's not too late, man. Like, it's not too late. It's not too late. When the checks arrive today, they literally start arriving today, the day that we're taping this, right? The government thinks, well, then people are going to open an envelope, see $450.
This is more than I paid. Holy fuck. This is awesome.
It's not what it's going to do. It's going to win votes. That check opening is actually going to drive voters toward Poilievre, which is an inexplicable perversity, but it's also predictable. Like, it's not too late. And I will tell you this. If I hear somebody say, in all seriousness, it's important that the carbon tax sends an important signal to markets. And that's what's so important about this. This is a market-based strategy. I seriously am going to pick up my not particularly well-functioning laptop right now and fucking hurl it at somebody. Like, that. It's not too late, man. You can say it's an alternative strategy or strategies. You can. I know that's not where the government's at, but it could literally say, we got a year.
Hopping on a carbon efficient train and getting itself to that destination.
They absolutely should. How much control do you really have over your financial records? There's a good chance you're among the millions of Canadians that just don't know. But tomorrow's federal budget will announce the first details of Canada's consumer-driven banking framework, also known as open banking. Our sponsor, Wealthsimple, is all for it. It will unlock secure ways for Canadians to share as much or as little financial data as they like to benefit them. Around the world, open banking is already empowering consumers. It can help aspiring homeowners build their credit score by proving they pay their rent on time, lower a teacher's mortgage rate by proving they've got a pension, and give a new parent a complete picture of their family's financial situation today to plan better for tomorrow. Millions of Canadians currently share their financial records in ways that aren't secure to use products that aren't as good as they could be. Open banking could improve security, increase competition, and help lower sky-high banking fees. And Wealthsimple is ready. I just got one quick last thing about this point, which is Poilievre's going to need another issue, isn't he? I mean, the election's a year and a half away, and I can envision lots of situations in which the carbon tax is not as salient an issue a year and a half from now as it is today. For one thing, how long can you sustain an issue? And, you know, you have to move on. Like, I have this little thing in my head. In the 1988 election campaign, Turner turned the election around on free trade, and he was beating Mulroney up on free trade. And his advisors were telling him, okay, you have taken all the juice out of free trade there is, and you need another front on Mulroney now if you're going to beat him. And that front is the GST, because it had been announced that they were going to do it, but it wasn't implemented in 88. And now you got a wheel on the GST, and Turner wouldn't do it because he was getting such great reaction to the speeches he was giving on free trade. And he felt that free trade was going to carry him all the way, but it petered out and ran out of steam. And he did need a second front. And it's not a perfect analogy, but I think Poilievre's going to need a second front.
I think there's a risk that he's actually been too effective in smothering the carbon tax issue, and particularly if the Liberals do make any move on it, that which they might be smart to do to take it off the table, then yeah, he's going to need that.
Yeah, but I agree with you, David, in theory, and I do think circumstances can change. I think, as you know, if Trump is elected president of the United States, I think it's going to scramble everyone's eggs, but there's an April 1st, 2025.
That there is. That there is. All right, I'll climb out of my own asshole and get back to real life here. okay, that is the end of our show, except for Gordon.
Ladies and gentlemen, please return to your seats. The Hey Yous are about to begin.
Hey Yous. All right, Scott, fire it away.
Corey made quick mention of this earlier on Friday. He and I, along with our pals from CTV, Vashi and Kathleen Monk, were at Civics. They brought in teachers from across the country, having their national meetings. These guys, since 2003, have been holding parallel votes, as they call them, in public schools and high schools all across the country. It's a mechanism to get people and get kids, get students interested in the competition that is elections. And as a consequence, you can smuggle into their brains how the electoral process works, how the governing process works, what the elements of it are. It's a terrific organization. It was great to be there. I've had a chance to be there many, many times over the past 20 years as their video of me looking like a younger person demonstrated. And so just a huge shout out to them. Their work is their work is tremendous.
Here, here.
That's here, cool. Here. Yeah, here, here.
Excellent. Wow. What a virtuous hey you. Now, what the fuck are the rest of us supposed to say after that? All right.
Why don't you bitch about the carbon tax someday? Small-minded dink.
Well, I'll take a stab at something then. My hey you's is to federal cabinet, and it's a plea for more cooperative federalism in terms of how it's approaching things. I think there are some ministers in this government who get that and who try to bring provinces and municipalities along with them when they bring ideas forward. I think of Dom LeBlanc in particular, you know, Wilkinson, even Freeland, you know, even Mark Miller, I think, at Citizenship has been doing this.
Who's the best example of someone that doesn't meet your standard, Corey? What's his name? Is he from Quebec? Does he have a beard? Is he 5'1"?
It's he whose name shall not be mentioned. Stephen Gilbert. There you go. I said it. I think Sean Fraser would do well to follow in the lead of those folks and to sit down with provinces and municipalities and get a deal. I think it's good for the country. I'll just throw in one other example because I think it's an affliction that you federal liberals have of wanting to do things at the federal federal government level and impose them on other people. I listened to Jane Philpott's.
We have a national vision. We have a national vision, Corey.
Yeah, and you're going to jam it down everyone's throat whether they want it or not. But
hey man, we can cut city council in Toronto in half.
I'm looking forward to reading Jane Philpott's book because I think she's got some interesting ideas around primary healthcare delivery.
Yep.
And I don't think the way to do this, you know, if you have a good idea like that, is then have the federal government impose it on everyone in a unilateral fashion. I think it's to actually do what she's doing. Write a book, go do some media, go talk to people, try to create a consensus, get people in alignment on it. And have it, you know, executed in a way that's maybe not identical in every jurisdiction, but takes the best elements of idea and propagates them. So anyway, my hey you is to the cabinet, you know, give cooperative federalism a chance. I think it's good for the country when you do it.
Right. Jordan?
I mean, I hear Corey, but I was listening to Danielle Smith this weekend, who's the standard bearer for the opposite. And I was astounded, like, that, you know, her response, for example, on the federal offer on the housing money and going direct to municipalities was that her, you know, her minimal government was going to just legislate that municipalities can't do that. I had a good chuckle about that.
Or said another way, what Quebec has been doing forever.
Right. But that's Quebec. So
well, okay,
that's but, a horse, you know. Of a horse of a slightly different color. Anyway, my Hey You this week is going out to the Canadian Labour Congress, because I Hey You'd out to the Canadian Labour movement a few months ago about how they needed to get their act together to make sure that Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives could not ride off into the sunset with the working class vote completely unopposed. And my Hey You this week is a positive one, because it appears that they are doing just that with a good old leaked memo, a classic but excellent strategy. It looks like the president, B. Brusque, and the heads of major labor unions in Canada are laying track for the fact that it will not be a free ride for Poilievre when it comes to getting workers and unionized workers' votes. That apparently, unlike the governing Liberals, they have remembered that he's got a record on these issues, and they are willing to talk about that record. And I'm really looking forward to see what comes out of them as we get closer to an election. That's my Hey You.
Excellent. Advertising. Maybe somebody will advertise something.
Imagine.
Right.
maybe all the union workers that are paying dues to the Labour Congress will change the leadership after the next election there, and and so it's more reflective of the people who they are said to represent.
Dream on, Corey.
Hey Yous are the Hey Yous are controversial this week. The Hey Yous are controversial this week. Mine is a call in response to Corey, because my Hey You goes out to Sean Fraser. Fuck, man, I love you. Have wrapped your arms around this file. You've come up with a set of policy initiatives that seem to be meeting widespread approval, and that people from all quarters seem to think these things are actually smart and will make a difference. You package them up well. You communicate them well. You're putting together good social products to sell them. You're the star of this cabinet. And I don't think we can ever win on housing, but it is a far better fight that we're in now than we were in when you got appointed to that job. So congratulations. Mm-hmm. All right. My need to thank you people for being here. Scott, try to get invest in technology. Like, what is with you? Buy a computer, something. Good God. Right? Corey can lend you the money.
There you go. Maybe not after the budget cuts.
He just needs some of my socialist internet.
All right. I need to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, our sponsor, CN Rail, Bruce Power, and Wealthsimple. All of you accursed for watching or listening to this show, and we'll see you next week with more of The Curse of Politics. In the meantime, take care of yourselves.